Hey there, I'm your host Alexis Newland and you're listening to The Brave Podcast. I am so happy you're tuning in today. Each week, a friend and I get together and talk about what makes them brave. So sit back, relax, grab your favorite cup of coffee or tea, and get ready for some engaging conversation. Hi everyone, thank you so much for listening to The Brave Podcast. And I'm your host, Alexis Newland. This is episode 34. Now, last week I mentioned, or was it 33? Sorry. It's either 33 or 34. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Last week I mentioned that Alexis Gorm would be the guest for this week. There was some technical difficulty, so you'll get to hear from her later on in October. So if you're looking forward to listening to that one, you have to wait a little bit longer. But my guest this week is amazing. Today, we're going to hang out with Whitney Bunker. Whitney Bunker is the co-founder of City Without Orphans here in Fresno, California. She's a former social worker, and she is a foster and adoptive mom. And she is so passionate about working in the foster care system and with adoption. She shares her own journey with adoption with her now two children and kind of gives us insight into what it's like in the foster care system. You're going to love our interview. I had so much fun talking to her, and I just absolutely learned so much from our brief time together. So without further ado, here is my interview with Whitney Bunker. This is The Brave Podcast, and I'm your host, Alexis Newling, and I'm here with Whitney from City Without Orphans. Introduce yourself, tell people why you're awesome.
Thank you. Okay, so my name is Whitney Bunker, and I am 34 years old. First of all, I'm a child of God and a wife of a pastor named Daniel, and a mother of two girls, 13 and 3, which is fun. And I have a social work background, but 10 years ago, I was able to start a nonprofit that I am co-founder with my husband with, but I'm the CEO currently, and it's called City Without Orphans. Yeah. And so I started that out of a heart for kids in foster care. I was working as a social worker at a foster care agency and seeing so many needs of kids and families that I was working with and seeing so many gaps in our systems. In being that I grew up in the church and loved the church body and just knew that there were so many resources and giftings and things that people could do in the church, and loved the community of Fresno and businesses and community members that cared for our city. And I felt like, gosh, someone should bridge the gap between all three of those kind of areas. Because if we work together, we could really help bring change in our foster care system. And that is when the idea to start City Without Orphans came about.
So how old is City Without Orphans again?
Yeah, so we will be 10 February of 2021. So yeah, we're almost on the decade mark. So I feel like we're I would say like a tween organization. Speaking of tweens, so we've had a little bit of experience under our belt, but I still feel like we're still young and still growing, growing a lot actually, especially over the last couple of years.
Yeah. Has your organization been affected at all by the pandemic with like finding assistance for orphans?
It's definitely affected the vulnerable most in our communities. All vulnerable people groups are being impacted the most. And so that includes orphans internationally and kids in foster care locally. The most population we're getting requests to serve right now is the college-aged foster youth. So some people aren't aware that kids in foster care now don't emancipate at 18. A newish law about 7 years ago, some former foster youth lobbied California and went to Congress and went to the Capitol and said, hey, you know, we're not ready to be on our own at 18. Some of them were still in high school, not even graduated yet, when they were kind of told, move along and grow up. And,
at
you know,
18, that was it. Like all services stopped, everything.
Yes.
Wow. That's
and
hard.
If you had a good foster family, they would say, hey, you know, take your time to finish school and we'll help you transition. And unfortunately, it's not all foster care providers, but some.
Okay.
That do not do it for the right reasons. And because of that, those youth were kind of thrown out on the streets to fend for themselves. And so we have a program called AB12, which is extended foster care. And those students, they get the services on campus. So if they're in a trade school or if they're in community college or university, there's federal funding to help support them on campus and programs.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Every Fresno City and all of the city colleges through the state of California have a foster youth program.
Fresno State
has a foster youth program. But what happens when your campus is closed and all the resources you normally get are on your campus and you are not on the campus because those people working there are sheltered in place and the quarantine's happening and you can't have your classes and you can't meet. So we had about 220 college age students who were impacted by foster care who were not having basic needs being met. And so we spent and are spending a lot of our efforts to really help bridge that gap.
Wow. So do they have any housing right now or...
Some of them had housing and some of them didn't. And those who didn't, we were able to connect them with people in the community. Some people in the summertime took some students and had them live at their home in the summer. Some of them were able to connect with a friend or sometimes even an extended relative that they had that they just didn't reconnect with. So if we do get calls about housing, we do assist with that. Most of the calls we were getting were more about basic needs, toiletry items, food. A lot of the food pantries were being impacted. The other thing that people don't often think about is transportation. So if many of the students don't have adequate transportation to get to where they need to go, especially for resources, that could be any type of resources, food, medical, whatever, that's a barrier for them. And so we even had folks dropping off care packages at people's doors because they couldn't go and actually get what they needed. There was one student that we worked with that she actually had kidney dialysis. She was in foster care. Her sister also had health problems. They lived together. And we were able to assist with gift cards, with food, with toiletries, with toilet paper. I mean, they were like, we can't find toilet paper anywhere. We have health issues. We can't get in line to wait in stores. So I'm super proud of our community. I mean, people really have been rallying for every time we do a drive or we go public on our social media and we're like, hey, we need this. People always show up. And so we couldn't do it without all of our supporters and our donors.
Yeah. Fresno is an amazing community. I work at the children's hospital and like our kids never have to worry about like when they're there for Christmas, not getting anything like the, and Fresno's a pretty poor area.
Yes.
And so it amazes me how giving our community is to people all over the Central Valley, despite the poverty. There's just people who have the biggest hearts here and who see a need and they find a way to meet it. And it just blows my mind.
Absolutely. I was just talking to a friend who lives in Texas and I was just telling her how everyone is always so critical of Fresno and other places. And the reality is that Fresno gets a bad rap oftentimes outside of our community, but people that really know our Central Valley and our Fresno County know that we have a lot of great people doing a lot of wonderful things.
Yes, we do. Our community is just so good. Yeah, and my mom, I remember when I first decided to move here over 10 years ago, she's like, why Fresno? Fresno is ghetto. There's gangs.
Yeah.
I'm like, yes, there's that.
Sure.
But there are some of the nicest people I've ever met in this community, and especially the church community here is just so giving and connected, and it's a great place to be. I'm glad you agree. Yeah, I love our
and we're happy to have you.
I have like a love for Fresno. I'm like, there's times like right now it's really hot, and I'm like, why do I live here? But I'm like, it's the people, it's the community, it's all of that.
I love it. Yeah, so good.
Yeah, definitely. So when you started fostering, was there any concerns or fears that you had getting into like taking care of a kid that's not your own?
Yeah, our story is kind of interesting. Ooh. As a couple.
Okay.
So we started our nonprofit before we actually became parents. So both my husband is a local pastor, and me being a social worker, we just saw a lot of needs of kids and families and thought, okay, it doesn't matter that we're young. I was only 25 at the time. And that we haven't parented, like God was calling us to this.
Okay.
But shortly thereafter, and we had talked when we were dating and even in early marriage that we always knew we wanted to adopt. Well, for us, it's the timing that we were in. I think being young and both starting our careers, we weren't ready for the baby yet. Yeah. Or like to get pregnant at the time. So we just thought, you know what? Why don't we adopt first? Everyone's like, oh, have your quote unquote own kids first. This is what a lot of people tell people. Have your own kids first and then adopt. And the reality is that for some people, plan A is adoption or fostering. Like, everybody's different. God's called people differently to start their family or to expand their family, and whatever that is, it's really about what God's calling you to and not the other person and what's around you and what people are saying. Second of all, when you adopt a child, you know, they are yours. And so the educating of like, okay, well, yes, most people have biological kids first and then they might foster and adopt. But we knew we had love in our hearts and room in our home and the commitment really to care for a child, because that's key, through the ups and downs, and provide them permanency if that's what they needed. Okay. And so we adopted first before even exploring like emergency foster care. Okay. Or tried to get pregnant. So, oh gosh, I would say it was November 2012 when we finished our classes to become foster adoptive parents. And you go through like a training, and it was a 10-week training. So it was pretty extensive. And I think there was about 28 hours we had to complete before we started the process as far as the paperwork and the interviews and whatnot. While we were at this training, we were in a mixed group of both foster parents, like people who were preparing to do emergency on-call foster care, and then others of us that were like, we aren't ready or don't feel called to actually do the emergency foster care, but we want to provide permanency if a child is not able to reunify with family, whether that be their parents or relatives. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that does happen. The goal and the hope is always for reunification, but for whatever reason, whether that be addiction or it's oftentimes addiction, 80%.
80%? Yeah. I didn't realize
80%
that.
Of the reasons why kids in foster care, at Fresno County at least, is neglect.
Okay.
But the reason that is neglect is because of substance abuse. Mm. So the substance abuse causes the parent not to be able to function at a way where they are caring for the basic needs of kids. And so neglect is kind of the biggest thing. So we were open to adopting. Actually, originally we had said, we'll take a child from like baby to 3 years old. And we kind of had this plan.
Yeah.
And I like to say, give your plans to God in pencil and let him erase it.
I actually like that. I'm keeping that. That's a really, really good idea.
Write your plans in pencil and give God the eraser, because he often will change your plans.
Exactly.
So we had it all planned. We're like, we'll adopt first, we'll do 0 to 3, and then we'll have a biological child, and then we'll adopt to third, and that'll be okay. Our kids, we'll have 3 kids, and that'll be the way we grow our family. And so when we completed this class, we became really good friends with a foster parent there. This lady was a wonderful woman who was a former teacher. So she was in her 60s, had retired. Okay. She was a former missionary as well. She did some mission work, and never been married, didn't have any children, but had just a heart to love on kids and really wanted to do emergency placement, foster care, and had a 3-bedroom house and was like, I'm willing to just help. I love kids and I have the capacity to open my home. Okay. And so we got pretty close with her in those 10 weeks and found out that she actually lived like 3 blocks from us, which was kind of funny and ironic.
Yeah.
And So when we completed the class, we swapped phone numbers and we just told her, look, we're in this process of adoption, which can take a little while.
How long does it typically take?
Well, I would say oftentimes in the beginning stages of going through the initial like home assessment, home study and the mm-hmm. paperwork and all of that, that could take like 3 to 4 months. And then you're just waiting to actually be matched. Okay. And so the matching could take 8-9 months like a baby, or wow. it can be years. It really just depends on how open you are as a family, as far as age and how many kids and their needs. There's just a lot that goes into okay. The wait time of adoptive parents. Okay. I will say, as someone who is a professional in the field, the more open someone is to a child or multiple children, the better it is in being matched. Whereas if you just want a white baby that's a newborn, you know, it's
harder to find.
Yeah. I mean, that's not what the need is in yeah. our community. We come from a diverse community. A very diverse community. We have children who are older that need to be adopted, and mm-hmm. older isn't necessarily what you think. And so we had set 0 to 3, and then God changed our plans, and longest story short, our friend Kathy, who was in our foster parent class, got a placement very quickly, because that's what foster parents do. They get calls in the middle of the night, they get calls early in the morning, and they take kids in. And so she called us, I would say probably only like 3.5 weeks after our last class, and said, are you good on your promise to help me out and just to be there for me in a moral support as you're waiting? Because I got placement of a 4-year-old little girl. And we were like, absolutely. Like, if you need respite, meaning like, do you need babysitting? If you need okay. someone to, you know, help you out. If you just, you know, we've got a dog and, you know, a family, we could cook you dinner. We just extended our hospitality to her to say, you're not in this alone, even though your family doesn't live close. We have a heart to help, and it'll be a little while for us. So yeah. She was excited to connect us and just have us as a support system to her. So we really didn't think anything of it. We just did what we had said we would do, and we did babysit. She'd go to a doctor's appointment or just have some me time. We had them over for dinner a lot. We even would meet like at the park with her, and it was super fun. Well, one day, I'd say about 3 months later, I get a call from Kathy, and she goes, okay, Whitney, don't be mad at me. And I'm like, okay, what is going on right now? Yeah. You start the conversation with, don't be mad at me. Where are you going now? With this?
Yeah.
And she said, we got a call that this little girl needed to be adopted. And the social worker is asking me, like, do you want to adopt? And I'm like, no, I'm not. This is what I'm not here for. Like, yeah. I'm here for temporary. But she was like, I told the social worker you and Daniel would adopt her. And I was like, what? And I just broke down crying, because I had no clue she needed a family. This was such an early part of her foster care journey, not knowing her family history with CPS. So I just didn't know that she needed a family. And so before I even talked to my husband, I told her, yes, we'll adopt her. Go ahead and tell the social worker.
How did he take that? Was he like...
Well, this is the crazy story, is because I actually hung up with the phone, called my husband, could barely get the words out. I was like sobbing, because I was just like, this was always God's plan. Like, we didn't see it, but like, God connected us all together so that we could be this little girl's parents.
That's so beautiful. And
when I told my husband, it's gonna make me cry, but when I told my husband, he said, I knew this already. And I was like, oh, so Kathy called you. Like, that's what I assumed.
Yeah.
He goes, no. He said, the first day I met her, God told me, this is your future daughter.
That's amazing.
But he said, I didn't want to get ahead of God. I know his ways and his plans are higher than mine. And so I just sat back and said, okay, you will be done. Like, just show us what is best for her. And like, I'll be there. And so that was the story of.
And you've already connected with her, with Kathy. And
she knew us already.
She knew you. That's wonderful.
We were already established in her life. And so I will never forget the day. Actually, it was 8 years ago this very week that we were able to sit down with her and tell her at five. She knew that she wasn't going to need to be going to another family. She's very bright and she knew her circumstances. And so we were able to tell her, you know, the social worker told us that we could be your mommy and daddy. And she just kept hugging us like over and over again. Like she'd hug my husband and then hug me. And bittersweet journey, a lot of loss. I don't take it lightly that someone else's family had to break apart in order for mine to start. So obviously, it's adoption is mixed emotions. It's beautiful and it's, devastating all at the same time, but children really thrive in families.
Yes, they do.
That's the way God created them to be raised in a family. And what that family looks like doesn't matter as much as it's a family. And it happened to be that God chose us for her. And I hate when people say, oh, your daughter's so lucky. No, she's not lucky that her first family fell apart.
And it's an awful thing.
She had to be adopted. But we feel blessed to have the opportunity as her parents. We feel honored to have the opportunity to be her mom and dad and to be there for her and to learn from her. And it's really our blessing. So
that is amazing. So I want to ask you questions about like emergency foster care. Like what happens in that? Like, you guys get calls no matter like any time of the night. Like what are things that some people might expect if they're interested in it?
So foster care in itself is one of those things that you do not know what you're getting until you get it. So when there's a drug bust at 2 a.m, when a child ends up at Valley Children's Hospital, when a mom gives birth, you know, at a hospital and, maybe the child tests positive for methamphetamines and there's not a good support plan and a child is placed on hold. There are so many unknowns, but essentially what they do is, they first look for family to see if there's any suitable family members that are approved and willing to provide placement for a child. And then if they're not able to do that in a timely fashion or they're, isn't anyone willing or suitable, they go and try to find a resource foster parent. So a resource parent is the same as a foster parent, essentially. But in the state of California, they've kind of changed the name. So I'll use them in like intertwined. But a foster parent essentially has to be ready at any time to get a call with very little information. So they can tell you kind of what they know as an emergency placement social worker. They get a call from the police department that a child needs to be removed. The police actually do the 300 hold and remove the child or the baby and work with the social worker who's the emergency placement worker to find a family. So the emergency placement worker will work with the agencies to get placement of a child. So that could be something that's 2 days or it could be something that's 9-10 months. You don't always know. Every once in a while, they have situations where, like I was saying, maybe it takes some time for a relative to come through. So they need to do maybe a real quick, only will take a week, background check or fingerprint. Or there's been situations where like a relative was in a different state and had to get time to get over to get the child. So a lot of times there's foster parents that will do just quick in and outs, you know, have them for a week, maybe 2 weeks until something else is arranged. But other times there is not support available and a family is in isolation And then they're in crisis. And so that's when a foster parent comes along and works the reunification track with a biological parent or parents, if there's two parents involved. Okay. That time frame really varies. Typically, I would say no more than 18 months. The judge does not like to string out CPS cases more than 18 months. And so if the parents are not doing what the court orders are, that could be, hey, 90-day inpatient. That could be parenting classes, domestic violence classes, all kinds of services that they're provided to be able to get healing, to learn parenting skills, to kick their addiction, all of that. They're given sufficient support and time to do what they need to do in order to get their kids back. And when they do well in their programs and they do visitations with their kids consistently, so there's set up visitations. Okay. They start out very supervised because they want to make sure things are healthy. They're getting the resources and they're being equipped. How does a parent who doesn't have custody of a child practice the new skills they're learning during visitation? So as the reunification process grows, the visitations come less supervised. So that parent after 6 months will be having, you know, a visitation where they'll have a kid for 3 hours and then give them back to the foster parent instead of having a supervision type of visitation. So the process kind of goes along. If the parent does not do what they're being asked to do, then oftentimes they will terminate parental rights.
And then once it's terminated, that's it.
Yeah. So when they propose a parental rights termination, the parent has the option to appeal if they're involved in the case, if they're not missing an action, you know, if they're going to the court hearings and meeting with their lawyer and all that, they can appeal it. But eventually they can only appeal it so much. And oftentimes judges won't go there unless there's due evidence that they have not completed what they have promise that they would to the courts. And at that point in time, we want kids to have permanency because we know that kids, you know, belong in families. And so that's when either they'll ask the foster parent themselves because they have the bond with the child. I mean, if you've been fostering for just say 14 months and the parental rights were terminated, you have a connection with that child has attachment and a bond. And so if it works well and you can do it, that's great. Some people go in saying, nope, I'm not going to adopt. I'm only going to foster. I have no intention of adopting. And they fall in love with the kid. And then they find out they need an adoptive home. And they're like, all right, let's do it. And others, which is okay too, say, you know, this is not my role. I know that there's parents that are waiting out there for this child. And I'm going to help prepare them to have healthy relationships and healthy attachments because God made attachment transferable.
Yeah.
And so they prepare them for a family who wants to adopt that child from foster care.
Okay. I always wonder when the kid goes from home to home, how does that affect them? Like, do you see like issues with attaching or feelings of like rejection that happen with children being in the system?
Absolutely. I wish the system was more trauma informed, but they're really not. And the more placements a child has, the more attachment issues are created. Children are resilient and a lot of kids still figure out how to love and be loved, which is incredible. Knowing their history, but yeah, it's not good for kids to bounce around, in the system. And so there has been some new laws that have kind of been put in place over the last couple years. Some reform to try to help the transitions be more smooth and kids stay in care less time in California. So I do appreciate that they're trying to streamline the processes, but it still ends up that kids bounce around from home to home.
And that's hard.
Yeah.
That is really hard. Yeah. And we'll see it on the hospital side. Just these kids will come back and it's just, I've had a couple of kids like the family was like, I'm done. Because there's some kids with behavioral problems. And so it's just hard to like, they just want to be loved. But at the same time, I don't know if it's, I don't know if I want to call it like self-sabotage or I don't know. Like,
yes.
Is that what it is? Like, I was trying to like not like say that, but like, is that what it is that they're doing? Or I don't know.
Well, attachment's an interesting thing. I think people do underestimate being tested by kids because that built trust and felt safety isn't always there right away. And kids will come in and try to test like their boundaries. We'll try to test like, what could I do for you to say like, no, I'm done. And so that is very common, especially when children have experienced a lot of rejection in homes and placements. They'll really try to push to see how far they can go. But also, you know, a lot of people forget that attachment and self-regulation, it starts in infancy. Mm-hmm. And you cannot self-regulate unless you co-regulate. And so as a baby, right?
Yeah.
A baby cries and says, I'm hungry.
Yeah.
I'm tired. I'm cold, right? That's their way of expressing their need. And a caregiver comes and meets that need over and over and over again, thousands of times. That creates attachment.
Okay.
And that's how those synaptic connections and neural pathways are made in the brain. And when you have a child who has neglect and they cry over and over and over and over again, and those needs are not being met, and no one is showing them how to soothe and how to regulate and how to calm down. In fact, they have the opposite. They're witnessing violence, domestic violence. They're witnessing so much hurt and pain and scary things around them. Those become survival skills.
Yeah.
Those are actually embedded sometimes not even cognitively aware survival skills that these kids and youth have that they use to adapt in society. And also, really, every behavior has a need. A behavior expresses a need. And so if we could kind of flip the script in the lens of instead of what's wrong with that kid to what happened to them, like mm-hmm. what happened that they're acting, you know, this way, we can have a better lens of compassion and we can be better equipped to understand how their brain works and why they do what they do.
That's fascinating. Yeah, it's just because I've run into kids and just kind of wondered myself. I'm like, man, like, why are you? But then when you flip it, it's saying like, what has happened to this kid to cause this behavior? It definitely like changes the script on it. And
Yeah,
it definitely does. And yeah, it's amazing. It's a sad system to see some of the things that these kids have gone through. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I wish there's a way to like just fix it and make it all perfect. But I'm glad there's places like what you guys have with City of Orphans and that we do have people in the foster care system who are willing to help and willing to step in and be the parents that a lot of these kids don't have.
Yeah. I'm thankful for, over the last 10 years, just seeing so many community members step up and care for kids. That's really important to me, to see everyone. It does take a village. I think it does take a group of people to say, hey, you know, I'm an educator and I want to learn about how to care for kids in foster care, kids who have trauma in my classroom, or, you know, I am a social worker, I'm a pastor, community member. And we're seeing more and more people step up. I think right now in this world that we live in 2020, my prayer is more people would be equipped to do the right caregiving. And even if that's less folks that actually step forward, I want people to have this knowledge of what it really takes in order to bring in a child who've experienced trauma and parent and care for them in a way that's attachment rich and trauma sensitive. If that were to go from 100 a year to 20, but the 20 that did it really did it with intentionality mm-hmm. and purpose and the proper education, I think that could make such a difference. And so I think I'm kind of flipping my own lens to from a, we need more people to now, okay, in the way that trauma is just exasperated in our lives right now and with everything going on in our world, we need the right kind of people stepping up and saying yes to this that can be equipped to heal and not harm.
Okay. So if people are interested in getting involved with the foster care system, want to help, how can they come to you? How can they reach you?
Yeah. You can reach me on our website. It's just citywithoutorphans.com or my email, which is easy. It's just whitneybunker@citywithoutorphans.com. We have, right now it's Zoom because everything's online, but we have like these pre-orientations we call Fostering Adoption 101, where we just sit down with people that are like, I've thought about foster care, I've thought about adopting, but I have nowhere to start and I have no clue what to do and I don't know the processes. We walk, me and another social worker on staff walk families or individuals. It's a myth that singles can't foster or adopt.
Yeah, which I was surprised when you said singles. I'm like, oh, I guess singles could. I thought you had to have like two person home. Nope. And
yeah, wow. That's actually a myth, which we love to bust at those workshops. Is that and the other thing is people are like, oh, I'd adopt, it's so expensive. And some type of adoptions are expensive. Private infant domestic adoption, international adoption expensive, adoption from foster care. Not. It's practically free.
Really?
Yes. So people don't know that it doesn't cost money to adopt from foster care. So we do a lot of those myth busting, education, informing, and those are going on all the time. So people could, and if that doesn't work to go in a group class, we also do one-on-one or two-on-one consultations with people.
And does it cost to come to you to get assistance?
It does, but it's very minimal because we subsidize as a nonprofit. So it's like under $20 to come to a class because
really
we really don't want that to be a barrier. And we understand that other people might be putting resources into, you know, maybe getting their home ready or, you know, there's costs to having a child just like you would biologically, you know, got to get a crib or a bed or, you know, all those other things. So thankful for donors who help us subsidize some of that.
All right. So what are some of your goals for yourself, for City Without Orphans, for the rest of kind of like the year? Or even beyond that.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Where do I start? So personally, this is kind of exciting because you're the first that I've like talked to about it publicly.
Okay.
So, it's a fun announcement that I can share on this podcast.
Okay.
But I'm in the beginning stages of writing a children's book.
That's brilliant.
And, it all just kind of came together very quickly and very godlike. where I have a lot of parents that are coming to me constantly that are foster and adoptive parents, but specifically more so adoptive parents trying to ask me about how do you talk to your child about being adopted? How do you talk to them about their story? You know, what do we do to go through this journey with our kids? And quite frankly, I'll be very honest because I wear two hats. I wear a social work hat.
Yeah.
And then I wear a parent hat. I can live in both worlds. And our agencies don't always equip families for the after journey.
Okay.
It's a lot of the like leading up to and during the process of the finalization. But once the finalization is over, there isn't always a lot of support.
Okay.
So our organization has kind of stepped in to do that. But families ask me all the time about that. So I share over and over and over repetitively the same kind of thing to families to help equip them. And one day I was just like, I feel like we need to have a book that could be not the typical adoption book, because there is a lot of children's adoption books that are more character driven. So it's like about a bird and he lost his mom. And so he's trying to find a new mommy. Mm-hmm. It's very character driven. What I am writing and in process of illustrating is it's really a guidebook for parents to have conversation with their child about their story. And essentially, we want that to be as natural and integrated into the life of adoptive family as possible.
Yeah.
My toddler, people always ask me, when will you tell your toddler she's adopted? She already knows she's adopted, and she's heard that word since she was an infant. And we read her stories about adoption. She can say the word adoption. She can say, I'm adopted. Now, does she cognitively, because she's three, put all the things together? Yeah. No.
Yeah.
But by the time my youngest is seven, you won't be able to say, did your mom sit you down? Did your dad sit you down?
Yeah.
She'll just be like, I always knew. Like, because it's literally been talked about. Pre-verbally even to her throughout her life. My oldest was obviously five when she was adopted. She knew exactly what was happening. She remembers her story prior to us, and she knows her story coming to us. She's now 13, and she knows every single information that I know about her story. She knows about her story.
Okay.
Because she's old enough to have that full story presented to her. She, as an adoptee, has a right to know her birth story, to know about what time she was born and how much she weighed, to look at her documents. That's not threatening to us. That's her journey and her identity. And so parents just need coaching in this way, because it's just really hard, I think, for some people to really understand it. So We Can Talk About It is a children's book that is coming out this fall, hopefully winter.
Oh, brilliant.
That will be just a short scripted book to help parents talk to kids about their story. And then in the back, we are going to include some stories from adoptees sharing their perspectives, stories from social workers and LMFTs sharing their perspective of talking about adoption and your story. And then me as well as a parent kind of giving tips and kind of that after the talk to parents.
Okay.
As they're, it's an ongoing conversation. So, yeah.
Wow. All right. So I have one more question for you. When did you decide that you were brave? I asked all my guests that.
Oh, my goodness. I have always been a like very tenacious girl. you can talk to my mom. I just was always kind of a go-getter, and it was really kind of outgoing, and I just really kind of took life by my two hands and just wanted to live it. But I also really struggled with anxiety.
Okay.
And I still do struggle with it. And so I think there was a lot of times where I would present being braver than I really felt. And it wasn't really until August of 2010 that I lost one of my best friends to cystic fibrosis.
Oh.
Her name was Jamie. And actually, next month will be the 10-year anniversary of her passing. And she was the bravest person I ever knew on the whole entire planet. And everyone who knew her, I mean, you are in the medical field. CF is...
It is
nasty. It's rough.
It is nasty. And it's taken a lot of kids.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's painful. And till her dying breath, she always fought for hope and for faith and for love. And she literally was intubated saying, tell them to love Christ. Tell them to serve Christ.
Wow.
And when she passed, I just had so much hurt. That was such a painful year for me. I actually was laid off from my social work job. So I was a social worker at an foster care agency before I started my organization. I had some health issues. I had some digestive issues that had cropped up. And so that was kind of a pain in my side, a thorn in my flesh. And then here, one of my best friends, she was in my wedding. She set my husband and I up, was fighting for her life, in the ICU. And she inspired me and still does to take a leap of faith. And, you know, tomorrow isn't promised and we only have one life to live. And I want to leave a legacy for my kids, for my family, but also for this world. And Jamie did that in only 24 years while suffering immensely. And so I just thought, if she could do it, I can do it. I love that. So that's when I knew I could be brave. Oh, is when she spread her wings and flew to heaven.
Oh, wow. So, it's been 10 years.
Yeah. August will be 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I'm thankful for you. I'm thankful for Jamie. And I'm so thankful that you were on as a guest today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
It was a great time to just share what God's done and pour out my heart.
All right. Thank you. Such a blessing. Okay. I'm going to turn this off. Right. Guys, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of The Brave Podcast. I'm going to put all info about City Without Orphans in the show notes so you can check out more about that. And if you're interested in getting involved in being a foster parent, I will put all of that contact info as well about their organization. You definitely, it's something you'd have to have a heart for. So if you feel like you do have a heart for something like this and Whitney's story stood out to you today, I definitely encourage you to connect with City Without Orphans and to kind of pursue that if that's something you really want to do. Children around here need good, wonderful families, and if you feel that you can provide that for them, I say go for it. All right, so before we go, I wanted to give you guys a heads up, and I mentioned this at the beginning of the podcast episode. I am going on vacation. I cannot wait. I will be gone the last 2 weeks in August. I'm going to Yellowstone. I'm really stoked. I'm doing a solo road trip to kind of like unwind, not work. So I'm not podcasting, not writing, not actually working at my daytime job. I'm just going to spend some time alone with the Lord on the road, camping in Yellowstone, visiting all the sites, and just enjoying being out of California. I love my state, but I just need to get out of here for a bit. So I will be gone, but you will still get your podcast episodes. So next week's episode is covered, and then I will be back in California in September, ready to give you guys more content. If you want to follow where I am and what I am doing, you can check out two places. My Instagram, my personal one, A Peach in Fresno, and my blogging podcasting one, A Peach in Cali. I will try to post what I'm doing or photos of where I am. So if you want to see where I'm doing and what I'm doing in the park, if I have, what do you call it, service, you can check out those two spots. I will definitely post there. All right, my three asks. My ask number one is to share the podcast. If you heard something today that you absolutely loved and thought that it could benefit another person, go on and share that with them. Secondly, ratings. Ratings is an awesome way to let me know what you're loving as a listener, because oh, you guys, this show is about you and what you love. And so if you really love something, rate the show, give whatever stars you feel like it deserves, and give me your comments and feedback. So you can actually, if you don't feel like rating, you can shoot me an email or a message. I love those. I read all of them, and I'm really thankful for my listeners. Finally, and I always blank on the last one, share, rate, subscribe. Yes, if you want to get the podcast episodes a day early, if you want to find out about any freebies or giveaways or what other things I'm doing in my life, you can sign up on the email list. You go to www.apeachincali, and that's spelled APEACHCALI.com. Go to contact us. Put your email in, you're on the list, you'll get emails from me once a week, you'll get the podcast episodes early, you may find out about freebies that I'm doing. It's a great way to stay in touch with me. Thank you guys so much. Next week, my friend Alex Schilling, and I might have said that wrong, and I'm so sorry, Alex. I need to get better about saying these guys' names, I promise you. He will be my guest next week. He's a former baseball player, and he's sharing about his youth foundation. You'll love our chat. Thank you guys so much for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye.